This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho, featuring inspirational and fascinating personal stories of people from all corners of the globe who are now in St. Louis. We'll take a look at the U.S. through newcomers' eyes, get some insight into world history and cultures, and maybe learn something about ourselves. Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Hey, welcome back to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL. I have two guests today for what proves to be a very interesting conversation. I've got Lucrecia and Marcelina da Silva from Angola, a mother and daughter team. So thank you for coming. First of all, welcome.
Hi.
I've known these two for many years, so this is going to be very, very easy conversation to have.
Right.
But as usual, let's start by kind of setting the scene. Where on the map is Angola? What countries does it border for people that might not be familiar with it?
Who wants to go first, Mom?
Don't all jump in.
Go ahead.
Yeah, Angola is on Southwest Africa. The countries border Angola is from the south is Namibia. And east, we have Zambia. And on north, we have Congo.
The Democratic Republic of Congo.
Yeah, which has changed its name several times in the past. Okay. And, you know, Angola, like so many countries, was, you know, had its own kingdom, its own history, and it was colonized by a European power for many years, in this case the Portuguese. And my understanding is that it kind of started out fairly well with the kind of like trade with between Portugal and the Congo, Angolan king. They kind of, one of the things they wanted to do was bring Christianity, and the king accepted Christianity, took a Christian name, João. Right. But then got it kind of brutal in some cases. Is that right?
Yeah, then the Portuguese start with a slave trade.
That was around the 1600s.
Yeah.
They came for the gold back in 1483.
Came for the gold and stayed for the people.
And stayed for the people. They had to find a way to sustain themselves, I suppose.
Yeah.
So 1600s was a slave trade. They say about 5 million people were traded bodily at the time and enslaved.
And they went mostly to Brazil, right?
And most of them went to Brazil.
Which was also a Portuguese colony.
But some to the United States as well.
Yeah, and to islands, I think.
Caribbean islands.
Caribbeans.
Mm-hmm. Okay, 5 million. That's unbelievable.
But the Portuguese really started settling in Angola around the 1800s, more permanently, I guess, more widespread, mm-hmm. opening up businesses and then also confiscating land, mm-hmm. Huge plantations that they had to.
And what was it that they were cultivating there mostly?
Cotton.
Cotton. And what else did you say? Gold?
Gold. They were mine.
Gold mines.
Diamonds.
Diamonds.
And diamonds.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And then they kind of imposed the Portuguese language on the people. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
We couldn't speak other language. We didn't go to school. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And our language.
What is your first language? Or is it Portuguese?
No. It's Kimbundu.
Kimbundu.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is a tribe, mm-hmm. that is goes from that part Luanda and a little that area, mm-hmm. because there were many languages in Angola, many tribes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, each tribe had his own language.
How many do you think there were, or how many languages? Dozens, hundreds.
No, probably. Hundreds, no, maybe.
Dozens.
Dozens, yes.
Well, this is probably another one of the countries that just had arbitrary borders drawn by the colonists, right?
Or
the colonialists,
yes.
Whatever.
Because they have their kingdoms.
Yeah. There was a kingdom, but I think the Portuguese didn't care about that kind of
where
stuff
exactly
when they drew the borders, they just
negotiated with the other European colonizers to decide where the borders were going to be.
Right.
But my mom talks about how the apartheid practices by the Portuguese were probably more severe than in the apartheid we know of in South Africa.
Oh.
In that they were probably more stringent. The population, the black population, was made to live in the outskirts of towns, right? Mm-hmm. They had no running water, no electricity. They still had to pay taxes. And they had certain raids that they conducted where they would come around at pre-dawn times and gather up men to work in the plantations.
To send to the plantations, coffee plantations.
Now, this was up into your lifetime also?
Up until this raids that I am talking about was on my time life.
So this was pre-independence, 1975,
The raids were, they call them rusga. They come, just get the people, the men, their houses, sit down, take them, and force them to go to work on this. They called it contract. Mm-hmm. Contract, but it was not contract because they were.
Were they paid for their work?
Yeah, but what? Nothing, almost nothing.
Okay.
For a year work.
Forced labor, basically.
Yeah.
And some of the men were sent to other Portuguese colonies outside of Angola, like Cabo Verde.
Mm-hmm.
And then those who left never returned. I mean, those who left the country.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Especially to São Tomé.
Uh-huh.
The slaves in Angola built the colony. And they were sent there to work on a cane sugar plantation.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're...
Well, I read that Portugal abolished slavery officially in 1836, but it sounds like there was a de facto form of slavery up until almost independence, I guess, right?
Of course. They always said that they had no apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
They looked like, for the outside, they had no apartheid like South Africa,
mm-hmm.
but they practiced apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
On a,
okay, you said your first language was
Kimbundu.
And did you speak that at home growing up?
No, because we couldn't speak Kimbundu.
Even at home?
Yeah, at home. Yeah, we can listen to our parents speaking.
Oh, you didn't know how to speak it? But
no,
you...
I know how to speak it. You live on
Was it illegal? That's what I'm getting.
No, it was not illegal.
Okay.
But
the
even
school, the school was in Portuguese.
The school was in Portuguese.
Okay.
But the people were so resilient that they kept their language.
Wow.
And they kept the history. Because what we know not from the Portuguese schools, mm-hmm. but from our ancestors.
Passed the story down. I'm not going to ask you how old you are, but you grew up in the 20th century, and the Portuguese had been in control for, 300 or 400 years by then? 500 years?
500 years.
So can you talk about your childhood? What kind of a school did you go to, and what was your neighborhood like? What was your family like?
I can say I was lucky to go to school because many other people want to go to school, and there was no school for them. We went to school because we lived in a town that the missionaries were there.
Portuguese missionaries?
Portuguese missionaries. And the nuns. And so we went to school, to those schools.
Catholic school?
Yeah, Catholic
schools.
But I know that there were some other denomination school too. There were some Americans that had school in my city,
Yeah, they said until the 1960s, the state schools were not for the local population. Mm-hmm. So the local population could only be educated by missionaries.
Did you have to pay for that? Was it free to you?
It was free. If you pay, you pay a fee at beginning. They call it the beginning, whatever. And you have to pay for the books and the, say, I don't know how to call that, matricula. You have to register, like a registration fee.
Did the Portuguese, what was it? You said it was Portuguese nuns, sisters?
Portuguese sisters, nuns.
Did they treat you well? Did they treat the students well?
Yeah, they did. But, you know, sometimes it's like we didn't know anything about our own history. Mm-hmm. But the nuns reminded us that if something was going it was not going well, and we complain. And she's many times they start saying that we are La Rainha Ginga. We think that we are Rainha Ginga because Rainha Ginga in history, Angola, he fought against the Portuguese.
What was his name?
Her name is Queen Ginga. Rainha Ginga in Portuguese.
Okay, I am familiar. Yeah, I've heard of that. Okay.
I think they made a movie or two about it.
I think so. And so the nuns told you to be proud of that?
No.
Oh.
They told us that we are just rebels like Rainha Ginga was. For them, Rainha Ginga was a rebel. And if something wasn't going good and we complained for something, they
called you Queen Ginga.
Queen Ginga.
Which is not a good thing. Got it. Okay. All right. What was it like as a child? Did you and the other kids in the neighborhood have fun playing?
Yeah. Everyone has the same. As a kid, you can't really know if you have everything that you.
Yeah.
Because the life was the same as everyone else.
Yeah. Looking back now, can you see signs of this apartheid that you and your family experienced?
Yes. One of those is not being able to live where they are. You live outside of the city, uh-huh. Everyone. We have no right to the electricity or water. Running water. They didn't care about...
You didn't have running water?
No. That was not the concern of the Portuguese. Mm. You can live, but outside of their...
There were...
You could work in their areas, though.
If you have a job, you can go work for them, but not everyone had a job.
And there were strikes, I guess... Revolts, revolution, you know, people did try to protest, but it was often
tamped down. Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's move forward a little bit. You, after you finished school, you married your husband, and what kind of work did he do?
When I finished school, I started working, teaching.
You did too.
Yes, after school. I started working, and then I met Geronimo.
Well, where did you teach? Did you teach in one of these Catholic schools or in a...
Yes, in Catholic schools, you missionary did. Schools. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, for 10 years I taught the kids.
Oh.
And then I met Geronimo,
mm-hmm.
And we... After that, we got married. And after that was the struggle started.
Well, yeah, that's the next phase of this conversation. This was right in the 60s, I guess you got married, or 70s?
Yeah, because when I was working, Geronimo was not in Angola. He was on Italy. He was studying on a Capuchin seminary. And then
Capuchin Seminary.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
And then he came and we met. I thought, yeah, after 4 years, we got married after he left the seminary.
And then shortly after you married, that's when things were getting crazy heading towards independence. And
was in March, I remember very well, March 1974. We got married in March 1974. And after that, April, the coup happened.
In Portugal, right?
In Portugal.
Yeah. Which I believe that Portugal had sort of, you know, a lot of other countries in Africa had gotten independence in the 60s
in
from
the
Britain
60s.
And Belgium and France. But Portugal held on to its colonies longer. But they were, I guess in theory, agreed to talk about independence. But then this coup in Portugal took their attention elsewhere, I guess, because they had problems at home. The coup, I guess it was a military coup in Portugal. So things kind of took a left turn in Angola. But
they just exiled the president. They took the president.
It was Portugal?
In Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't fight or struggle. They just took him.
But it was a regime change. And
yeah,
so
regime
things,
change.
Things
yes.
were, they were preoccupied. We need to take our first short break here, and then we're going to come back and pick up the story. You're listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Meu avô contava, seu grande sonho era ver sorrisos.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by Arnell's Hardwoods. For all of your laminate and hardwood flooring needs, call them at 314-397-3252.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by the Indoor Comfort Team. For all of your heating and cooling needs, call the Indoor Comfort Team at 314-230-9542.
This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
All right, welcome back. We're talking with Marcelina and Lucrecia da Silva from Angola. And we were just talking about the path to Angolan independence. 1975, you said, independence came, but there was, after Portugal had its coup or and its regime change back home, they kind of left Angola to its own devices, it sounds like, in a way. And there were two or maybe many more political parties that struggled to get power in Angola after independence. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that was a little bit briefly?
Yeah. After that, there were three parties. They came to Angola because they were fighting on outside on bushes. But then they could come in Angolan cities, and they were campaigning for the elections. Mm-hmm. While they were doing this, I think the Communist Party in Portugal favored MPLA
and
gave the power away to MPLA. And the two other groups, FNLA and La UNITA, they fled, they left. And then they decided together to join together and make front the MPLA to fight MPLA. But that didn't happen because when they were doing in between, UNITA started fighting the other. It was FNLA.
So, they fought among themselves.
Yeah.
So UNITA and FNLA were allied to begin at first for a very short time before UNITA started fighting against FNLA and MPLA at the time.
And you said MPLA was supported by the Communist Party of Portugal and maybe other places.
Yes, other places.
Which therefore, because this was the 70s, you know, certain other countries gave support to the opposing parties.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, they did. Maybe they were thinking that they are the best, the one, the best, but it wasn't.
It was definitely an effort to counter the communist presence in the country. So,
mm-hmm. So the United States was among that effort, in that effort. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe people may have heard the name Jonas Savimbi, who was the mm-hmm. UNITA leader. And I remember him sitting down with Reagan a couple times for meetings. Mm-hmm. How did that eventually play out then? Which team won?
Yeah, finally, even Savimbi didn't win because MPLA, when we were all together, and Savimbi started persecuting the other ally. Mm-hmm. Then MPLA was coming to where, because this is South Angola, South, and MPLA was new in power and was coming to get all the country, and we were left in the south part of the Angola with those two groups. MPLA was advancing mm-hmm. while UNITA was fighting FNLA. Then he at the end, we all has to come out. We came out, we went to Namibia.
Well, yeah, with all this fighting, there were thousands, hundreds of thousands of civilians that mm-hmm. were displaced, right? Killed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Had to flee.
Absolutely. Since practically 1975 until the end of the Civil War in 2002, when they finally reached a ceasefire agreement after Savimbi was killed, hundreds of thousands, if not more, were killed. They estimated that between 1992 and 1994 alone, that 2-year span, up to 400,000 people were killed just in that time frame. But clearly,
it was devastating for the entire country. The fighting to MPLA was fighting MPLA because FNLA quit fighting and said, "We don't want participate in civil war." He fought. And they fought for 14 years before the independence. And then they started the civil war and he said no. But Savimbi went on fighting.
Until he was killed. And then what made your family eventually decide to leave or have to leave? I know it's a long story, but...
Yeah, it's a long story. But we couldn't stay. What made us leave? We couldn't stay on that same place because MPLA would have killed us because we belonged. It was that thing. If you belong to this party, to a different party, you are enemy. Mm-hmm. And they killed all the people who belong to other part. That's why we
had... their lives were in danger, basically. I mean, my father... had witnessed executions. Mm. He himself was almost killed.
Yeah.
But that was with UNITA. When UNITA decided that we will fight the people, the other party, that they made
an agreement
to fight the MPLA. UNITA started fighting the other party.
So there were millions of people that left the country during the Civil War to Zaire at the time and to refugee camps mm-hmm. all over. Eventually, my parents and my older brother and sister made their way across the southern border into Namibia.
This is before you were born.
This is way before. Well, not way before.
Not way.
No, it was just the older sister because... your brother was not even born.
Oh, only Monica?
Only Monica, baby. He was 1 year old.
Okay.
And
you said you decided to go to Namibia. Why Namibia? Was that the closest neighboring country?
No, because we're not just us. All the family, it was like 2,000 family all leaving Angola.
Right.
To go somewhere.
But why Namibia?
Namibia because it's the country that borders
okay.
Angola. We came from Angola
yeah.
all the way down. And then, because when Empeliao was coming from north to south,
mm-hmm.
and then we had to, when we got to Namibia, by this time, the South African military was helping people who were fleeing.
Helping you, helping refugees?
Yeah, helping okay. refugees in their cars, because we, by this time, we didn't have means to
flee the war. How did you flee the country? Did you go on foot, by bus, train?
Yeah, we had one bus. All the family get together, and because the Portuguese had left everything.
Oh.
And one of the families
they just left everything.
Yeah, they were living close to the one of the, this family was yeah. living close to the bus station. They left the buses mm-hmm. and the families some they got together and they said we have to leave. We can't stay. But how? And they said, well, let's take a bus. And one of them drove the bus
wow.
before us.
How far were you from the border with Namibia?
It's far, very far. From, if you know Angola, from a new Huambo. Now it's Huambo. Before it was Nova Lisboa, New Lisbon.
One of the provinces.
Southern provinces.
Approximately how many miles? Just generally.
I don't know.
Dozens, hundreds, thousands?
I don't know. Maybe one.
A lot.
1,000.
Oh, okay. And then when you got to the border, did you know where to go to the refugee camp? Did you know where to go?
Or? No, by this time we were not, because our bus, break down on the road. And then the military, because it was like after the 26th of March, it was the last day that the ONU, watered South Africa, leave Angola.
ONU is the United Nations.
And they were leaving too, because South Africa were there fighting against the Empelier,
oh.
because he was with helping Savimbi and was fighting.
Right.
But then the ONU,
UN
told them that was the last day that has to leave.
Okay.
And we were coming with them.
And then you wound up in a refugee camp somewhere, right?
Yeah, with the refugee camp, with the military. Because on the road, our bus broke down and we got to ride with them. We had to ride with them on their trucks.
What was this camp like? How big was it?
Oh, it was on a bush.
In the bush.
We got there. It was, and then we had to, they gave us some tents.
Tents, that was my next question. You had tents. Did each family have its own
no,
tent?
No, not every family.
Did the United Nations run this camp?
No, it was South Africa.
Oh.
The South Africans, because we came with South Africa.
And you know how many people were there?
2,000 families.
Were they only from Angola, or were they refugees from other countries too?
No, only from Angola. 2,000 family without counting the children, because it's just a family.
And were there both MPLA and UNITA supporters there among these refugees?
No MPLA on that group.
Only
UNITA okay. and FNLA.
Okay.
Because
the aggressor was MPLA.
Well, you know, you hear about other, like what happened with after the war in Rwanda with both Hutus and Tutsis winding up in refugee camps in Congo and Tanzania and... You know, anyway, what was life like? How were you fed? Were you given like a certain amount of rice per month or something that you had to
close? Because we came without anything,
wow.
and they gave you clothes, some other stuff.
What kind of food was it?
They gave good food at the beginning, because we stayed in that camp for 2 years.
Okay.
The beginning. South African treated us well with the food.
Yeah.
And then they asked, they wanted the help from United Nations, and they didn't get it because of their regime, apartheid regime.
Really?
Yeah, they didn't.
So and they, that led to the suffering of other people.
Because they couldn't afford us. And they told us, we can't afford you. If you want to go back, you can go back. Or each one, find where to go, because we can't afford United Nations. It will not help us.
Well, what did you do then?
Yeah, then other people went back.
Back to Angola?
Yeah.
Had things calmed down by then?
Yeah, I don't know.
No.
Because the MPLA was still there. I don't know what happened to them.
And Marcelina, you were born there. Were you born around this time?
Yeah, but after the camp closed.
Where did you go from there?
We found a way to go to the Windhoek, where she was born.
Which was another apartheid city.
Yeah, the cap. Okay, you were legally able to go there and live there?
Oh, yeah, we had to find something to support ourselves. You have to look out where to go. We said we can't go back. We can't go somewhere. Some other people went to the military base.
Windhoek. Okay, this is the capital of Namibia.
Yes,
and it was originally colonized by the Germans, so people spoke German. Maybe, but
Afrikaans.
That is English and Germany,
Dutch.
By this time, though, Namibia was under the control of South Africa, right?
It was a South African protectorate.
And so then did you have to speak English in Windhoek or German or Afrikaans, or did you know English at the time?
No English.
Did Geronimo speak
no
English?
Afrikaans.
No. This is a very, very long story that has many chapters in it. But it's all about surviving and struggling, because they were basically homeless, right? And really living by the grace and
day by day, whatever.
And the random people helping, seeing their needs,
local
and
people.
Locals and others.
How long did you live like that there?
Yeah, we lived like that for 12 years.
12 years.
But so, then we Geronimo got the job and he started working. And then we got the house. We got the house. And we stayed there for 12 years where she was born.
And then other siblings were born there too? Because...
Yes.
There are six now. How
many? The rest of us were born in Windhoek.
Okay,
Windhoek, but the outskirts of Windhoek.
Joka was born in a refugee camp, and the one just closed, the first refugee camp in Namibia.
Okay. Well, it's time for another break, but when we come back, we have a lot to cover in the last section, but I want to talk about coming to the United States, because where Marcelina can jump in a lot. I want to hear more about your experiences, but... You're listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL. Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by Samim Afghan Restaurant, featuring traditional Afghan cuisine and conveniently located on Manchester Road in the Grove.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you by Hacking Law, for individuals who want to come and stay in the U.S. Hacking Law fights for immigrants every day. Visit them at hackingimmigrationlaw.com.
This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Okay, welcome back to Stories of New Americans. Now, you lived in Windhoek, Namibia for 12 years, and Marcelina, you and your younger siblings were born there. And then how was it that you came to the United States? Did you have to go to the American Embassy?
Yeah.
Would you have been able to remain in Namibia, legally?
Legally, I don't know, because we didn't have any documents from Namibia, I guess.
Okay.
We didn't. We right. are refugees.
So when I was born, I was considered state. I'm, you know, Namibia didn't give me a birth certificate.
Oh.
For whatever reason, they uh-huh. didn't issue one. So we were basically stateless because we were born wow. refugees. And in 1988, they were going through those, you know, their own struggles to get independent from
yeah, this was South the Africa. Reason that we decided to leave Namibia, because we didn't want to go through whatever we went through back in
was
Angola.
Was it getting kind of tense at that time?
Yeah, we thought it will be. We yeah. thought it will be then, not just us, many other families okay. thought the same to leave Namibia. And we knew that we can apply for to come in America.
Did you speak English then?
Nobody spoke English.
Okay, that's what's fine.
We took a little blue Datsun pickup truck down mm-hmm. from Windhoek. This was 1988, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With six kids in the back. And drove the length of the country. If you look at a map, Namibia is really long. So
yeah.
into South Africa, into apartheid South Africa.
Yeah, South Africa.
To yeah. get into Botswana, where there is a refugee camp where they were regularly interviewing people. For
the qualified to come, to left, to leave.
To come here as
refugees. To come to the United States.
You had to go to Botswana for this?
Yeah, we all have, right. because Namibia didn't have an embassy. Because of the
what about South Africa?
Apartheid
South
Africa?
South Africa, apartheid.
Was there an American embassy there?
No. I guess no, because of their
okay.
regime at yeah, that time. That now, time. Yes.
Okay. All right. Botswana. So then, did you have an appointment there? Did you just walk in and sit until they called on you, or how does that work?
We get word from other people. And we applied while we were in Namibia.
Oh.
And we sent our application to Botswana.
So you had an appointment?
Yeah, kind of. We okay. had already.
All right. Was that nerve-wracking? Did they ask you a lot of
it was
difficult questions?
Not the embassy, but the police, the country. Mm-hmm.
In South Africa?
In Botswana.
In Botswana.
Yeah.
To enter the country.
Yeah, to enter the country oh, was really? Very hard. Mm-hmm. I can say it was a miracle because yeah, they didn't.
I think there were a lot of miracles in your life.
Yeah, a few hundred.
They didn't want us to pass. And some other family, we came after us. They didn't
wow.
get the thing. But we.
Were you told that first appointment that you had been granted refugee status, or did you have to go back home and wait to hear?
No, we couldn't even tell them that because they didn't want people coming to their country.
But when you went to Botswana to talk
yeah,
to
Botswana. Oh.
Did they tell you, yes, you're in?
After the interview?
Yeah.
No, I think you had to wait for a decision.
Oh,
or did
yeah.
Did they
stay
tell you
in
immediately?
Botswana or go back to Namibia?
We were in Botswana. We were in a refugee camp.
Oh,
we were
in Dugwe.
Yeah.
Okay.
For at least 2 years before we were allowed to come to the United States.
Who was in that camp? People from... Several countries? Or?
Yeah, several camp people. There were people from
South Africa.
South Africa. There were people from Zimbabwe.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And people from Angola.
Angola. All right. All right. Well, let's jump ahead. When was it that you finally came to America? What year was that?
1990, February. The day not the day, but around the time Mandela was released mm-hmm. from prison.
Oh, okay. That's an easy way to remember it. Mm-hmm. You came directly to St. Louis.
Yes, because we applied for St. Louis and we had the answer that they had accepted us. We waited 2 years on that refugee because the government was going through the transition. It was oh. just elected a new president that uh-huh. was who?
Botswana?
No, Bush.
States. Oh, here?
Yeah.
That was the first Bush, I guess, in 1980.
Yes, it was first Bush. Mm-hmm. That's why we stayed all that time,
oh,
2 years.
Okay. Well, you came here in St. Louis. Had any of you learned English in those ensuing 2 years before you came?
I was 8 years old in 1988. And I remember trying to learn some English.
Yeah, we all tried to learn some English. And I remember reading some books in English.
Yeah. When we knew we were coming to the United States, there was a little bit of an effort to go to the library and start to try to learn things. At the refugee camp, they had like movies from the United States showing, and we would go every, I don't know, however often they had the movies showing.
And the books, too, in the library.
And the books. I remember
Didn't like to read. He used to send, he used to go to the library, get a book, and bring it, and give it to Harp to read to him.
Some things never change. All right, so you said you came here in February. It was probably pretty cold then.
Yes.
Was that a big
shock?
It
was cold, yes.
It was a huge culture shock. Mm. I remember feeling like there was something wrong with the world. Obviously, I was 10 years old when I came. So we went through London to fly to New York to get to St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And London, I don't think we were appropriately clothed. We were coming from desert-like conditions in Southern Africa. And I don't think we got fully or well informed about what the attire should be.
Oh, did you even have a warm clothes?
Did
to
I
bring?
Have a warm coat? I'm not even sure.
Nobody had a warm coat.
Were you sponsored by the International Institute here?
Institute, or? Yes.
Okay, so did they meet you at the airport, bring you to an apartment?
Yes.
And then
they
how were those first days or weeks?
It was surreal.
Yeah.
It was a real culture shock.
He left us on the apartment.
Oh, and we didn't about this.
Yeah.
We didn't even know how to put on the heat or turn the heat on. Mm. And yeah, and back there they told us people in America, they are not friendly. Don't just close your doors, don't speak to anyone, and do this and that and that. And and we were like afraid the doors close and indoors, so that Emmanuel, after some times, he was crying.
Son.
Yeah, crying. He wants, why are you crying? I want to go back. Why? Because I can't play outside.
Yeah. Did you all go start school then shortly after you arrived?
Yes.
We were put in schools.
In
schools. Okay. That was weird. I mean, everything was new. Everything was weird. Obviously, we weren't used to a city this size. We never lived in a city this size. New York was a complete... This is from the lens of a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unfathomable how interesting it was. But you also... We're scared to get around because all the houses look the same.
Yeah.
So you don't really have those markers you usually have. Turn right at the pink house.
Or, yeah.
So we were taught to be cautious. There were orientation type classes that we took before we left the refugee camp. So, okay, Americans, they don't stop to talk to you. So don't expect that. You know, like... so it took us a while. Where to get groceries... Even though we did have somebody from the International Institute, I think there were just some basic things that...
Those people, they just came over to let you get some vaccines, some...
to get the social needs and health and...
Health needs.
Were there interpreters at the time? Did they have Portuguese interpreters?
Probably. No.
No.
Our caseworker was even... from Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was a 2-bedroom apartment for the 8 of us, which was fine because, you know,
it became
better than a tent.
Yeah, but there was a lot of growing pains.
Yeah.
I remember walking to school, walking to the school bus with my younger brother, and being made fun of because of the clothes we wore, because of, we were all like shoes, hand downs.
Monica went to school with flip flops.
In the winter?
No winter. Gosh. Without coat.
Yeah.
And we didn't know how to dress up for the cold. And we did, we had no clothes either. And then we didn't meet Sister Paulette yet. Yeah. Someone told me to have some clothes to call the Will Good Story. They gave me the number. I called, and then we went there to shoot some clothes without paying.
I think it really turned around after we met our church community. Mm-hmm. That was when things started falling into place, and Sister Paulette and the refugee ministry there really helped. And everybody was so kind. That's, I think, one of the things that my mom wanted to stress is that unlike what they were telling us at the refugee camp, people were actually very kind and helpful.
So friendly. Yeah. I said, what? They told us it? You can't say anything. But they were very kind people.
Well, obviously, you survived the last, 20, 30 years now?
Who knows? Nobody's counting.
Well, we got a few minutes left. There's a lot I want to talk about. You both have gone back to Angola to visit once or twice, right?
Yes.
How has it changed, if at all, since you left? Or you never seen it before, Marcelina, because you were not even – you were born somewhere else, but
I didn't like the way that I found Angola. I was so mad, but they were excited because they did. I said, "You guys are so excited because you don't know
what it was before."
What was before?
This was 2003 when we decided to go right after the end of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Angola was in a disarray, to say the least.
Was there at least some semblance of peace?
There was peace, and there were people that were very happy to not be in war and rebuilding, but obviously starting from the bottom. Mm-hmm. But I did get a chance to go back in 2006 and 2007. And
things were improving.
They were improving.
Yeah.
Angola was going through like a double-digit economic growth in the early 2000s. So really taking advantage of its resources to improve living conditions and just sort of rebuild.
The MPLA is still in power, and this new president is Lourenco. Is that his name?
Lourenco, yes.
Is he okay? Is he doing?
Well, from what I hear now, he's not doing I think he's not doing well, not doing good for the country. Not happy with.
Oh.
I said that the other one was the same.
Not a big difference. Yeah. Would you ever go back to live there?
No.
No?
Mm-mm.
Would you?
No.
No? So do you feel more Angolan or more American now? Or maybe both?
Definitely American.
Yeah.
How do you keep your Angolan culture alive? I know you all of you kids speak Portuguese, I think, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I know you speak Portuguese to each other. You probably answer in English, but I know your mom tries to speak Portuguese to you. And I know you make my favorite dish, risos de camarão. You make that special Angolan shrimp dish I like. But how else do you keep the culture alive? Or do you?
We don't really. We keep a culture just in our own family because there's no people like other refugees. There are so many on the same city.
There aren't that many Angolan families.
How many are there? Just a handful, I guess, right?
Yeah. Here it's just us and one or two.
Well, let me ask you this. What is the best and the worst thing about living in America?
The best thing I like in America is the peace. Mm. You have peace, no war. And is like, how to say, the security that you don't find in other countries. Mm. How to say that?
It's a stable.
It's a stable.
Okay.
And it looks like a justice.
Okay.
Is
possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
Attainable. What do you think, Marcelina? Well, choose either best or worst in 30 seconds.
Yeah, no, I agree. Stability is huge for those of us who've been refugees.
You don't appreciate it until you don't have it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going to choose that as the best.
And the opportunities, too. If you want to go to school, if you want to learn, if you want to work, you can do that. In other countries, you can't. Mm-hmm. Even if you want to do something, it's hard.
Do you want to say something else?
No, I think I'll stick with that answer.
Good answer. All right. Well, we're almost out of time. I really appreciate your coming in to talk with me. I wish we had more time, as usual. But thank you again. Obrigado. That's my one Portuguese word. Thank you. You've been listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL 101.9, 94.1. Thank you for listening.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.